Penguin Random House Audio presents Tom Clancy, Duty and Honor, by Grant Blackwood. Read for you by Scott Brick. Chapter 1. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack Ryan Jr. would later wonder what exactly had saved his life that night. One thing was certain, it hadn't been skill. Maybe the heft of the bok choy had bought him a split second. Maybe the mud, but not skill. Dumb luck. Survival instinct. The supermercado was neither in his neighborhood nor near his frequent errand stops, but it did have the best selection of fruits and vegetables in Alexandria. So Ding Chavez had told him 8 months ago, but it had only recently, since his forced leave of absence from the campus, that he'd become a believer. Being unemployed had given him a lot to think about and plenty of time to broaden his horizons. The one frontier he'd so far refused to explore, despite his sister Sally's exhortations, was binge-watching girls on HBO. That was his Rubicon. No crossing the river for the Roman legions, no chick TV for Jack Ryan. Soon, though, he'd have to make a decision about his loose ends lifestyle. Another couple weeks, and his probation would be over. Jerry Hendley would want an answer. Was he coming back to the campus, or were they parting company permanently? And do what? Jack thought. He'd spent most of his adult life working at the campus, aka Hendley Associates, first as an analyst and then as an operations officer. A field spook. The off-the-books counter-terror organization had been created by his father, President Jack Ryan, and had since its inception been overseen by former Senator Jerry Hendley. So far, they'd had a lot of success going after some of the world's big bads, while still managing to make a decent profit, not only for their clients, all of whom knew Hendley only as a financial arbitrage company, but also for the campus's covert operational budget. $17.50, the cashier told him. Jack handed her a 20, took his change, then collected his brown paper sack from the glum teenage bagger and headed for the door. It was just past 8 p.m. and the store was almost deserted. Through the broad front windows, he could see rain glittering in the glow of the parking lot's sodium vapor lights. Accompanied by a cold front, rain had been falling in Alexandria for 3 straight days. Creeks were swollen, and the DIY stores nearest the Potomac were seeing a jump in sandbag sales. Perfect weather for homemade slow cooker chili. He'd just put in a solid 8 miles on his gym's indoor track, followed by a 20-minute circuit of push-ups, pull-ups, and planks, and he hoped to turn his bag full of ground beef, beans, peppers, onions, tomatoes, and bok choy, his mom's most recent superfood recommendation, into a reward for all his sweat. The chili wouldn't be ready until tomorrow. Tonight, Chinese takeout leftovers. The automatic door slid open and Jack used his free hand to pull his sweatshirt's hood over his head. It was a short walk to his car, a black Chrysler 300 and the first sedan he'd owned in a long time, and then a 15-minute drive back to his condo at the Aronico. The parking lot's surface was new and its fresh coat of asphalt shimmered black under the slick of rain. Moving at a half jog, feeling the chilled rain running down his chin and into his shirt, Jack covered the 30 yards to his car, which he'd parked trunk first against the guardrail. Old habits, he thought. Be ready to leave quickly. Know your closest exits and highways. Months of civilian life and still a lot of the fieldcraft rules John Clark and the rest had taught him hadn't faded. Did this tell Jack something? Was this just a shadow of a habit or inclination? As he neared his car, he saw a sheet of white paper stuck under his windshield wiper. A flyer. Food drive, garage sale, voting reminder. Whatever it was, Jack wasn't in the mood. He leaned sideways and reached for the flyer. Sodden, it tore free in a clump, leaving a narrow strip trapped beneath the wiper blade. Shit, Jack muttered. From behind, a voice. Hey, man, give it up. Even before he turned, the tone of the man's voice, combined with the time of night and location, had touched off Jack's warning bells. The supermercado wasn't in the best of neighborhoods, with its fair share of crack-driven homelessness and petty crime. Jack turned on his heel while taking two steps backward, hoping to buy time and room to maneuver. The man was tall, nearly 6.5 feet, and gangly, his head covered in a dark hood, and he came from Jack's left at a fast walking pace. Overhead, lightning flashed, casting the man's face in stark shadow. Break his pattern, Jack thought. Having targeted his prey and committed himself to the attack, the man, a crackhead or tweaker, Jack guessed, was laser-focused, confident this role would go like all the others. Jack needed to change that. He took a step toward the man and pointed. Fuck off! Go away! Junkie muggers rarely saw this kind of victim aggression. Wolves prefer weak sheep. But Jack's belligerence had no effect. The man's pace and his locked-on gaze at Jack didn't waver. His right hand, hanging beside his thigh, rose up to his waist, palm away from Jack. He's got a knife. If his attacker was carrying a gun, he would have already brandished it. With a gun, you could put the fear of God in someone at a distance. With a knife, you needed to get close enough to put the blade against your victim's face or neck. And the palm away knife grip told Jack something else. The man wasn't interested in scaring him into submission. It was easier to strip valuables from a dead body. Jack's heart was pounding now, his breathing going shallow. He swept his right hand to his hip, lifted the hem of his sweatshirt with his thumb, his palm touching. Nothing. God damn it! He wasn't armed. He had a CCW permit, but had stopped carrying his Glock the day he left the campus. Keys. His car keys were in his pocket, not where they should have been, in his hand, as a backup weapon. Lazy Jack. His attacker hadn't missed seeing Jack's flash of hesitation. He sprinted forward, right hand sweeping up and out in preparation for a crosshand neck slash. As though passing a basketball, Jack heaved his grocery bag at the man. It bounced off his chest, the contents scattering across the wet asphalt. This broke both his pattern and his stride, but for only a moment, and did not leave enough time to create an opening for Jack's own attack. Retreat, then. Live to fight another day. There was no point in getting in a knife fight if he had a choice. He turned, sprinted for the guardrail, vaulted it, and landed in mush. Below him, a slope with patchy grass and cedar ground cover met a line of concrete jersey barrier along the highway. Behind him, Jack vaguely registered the man's footsteps, picking up speed on the pavement. He started shuffle sliding down the embankment, using the scrub brush for footholds. His attacker was fast. A hand clutched Jack's hood and wrenched his head backward, exposing his throat. Jack didn't fight it, but rather spun hard to his right, into the man and toward what he guessed would be the descending knife blade. And it was there, arcing toward his face. Jack lifted his left arm and drove his forearm down, diverting the blade and trapping the man's arm in his own armpit. With his right hand, Jack reached up, fingers clawing at the man's eyes and pushing his head sideways. Together, they fell back, Jack on top. They began sliding down, churning up mud and grinding over cedar stumps as they went. The man was flailing, but with purpose, Jack realized. Trying to free his knife arm from Jack's armpit, the man reached across with his left hand, grabbed Jack's chin, and wrenched his head sideways. Pain flashed in Jack's neck. One of the man's fingers slipped into his mouth, and Jack bit down hard, heard a muffled crunch. The man screamed. Still entwined, they slammed to a stop against one of the jersey barriers bordering the highway. Jack heard a sick-sounding thud, followed by an oomph. Through squinted eyes, Jack saw the flash of headlights, heard the hiss of tires on the wet pavement. The man was rolling sideways, crawling on his hands and knees. Lightning flashed again, and Jack could make out a bloody divot in the side of his skull. A flap of scalp drooped over his ear. Skull fracture. A bad one. Jack was crawling also, but in the opposite direction toward the embankment. He got to his feet and turned. The man was already up and lumbering toward him. Like a drunk trying to walk a line, the man crossed his feet and staggered, gathering momentum until he plunged face first into the mud. Swaying, He pushed himself to his knees. He reached up to touch the side of his skull, then stared at his bloody hand.
"What is..."
the man growled, his speech slurred.
"I need a... need the..."
He scanned the ground as though he'd lost something, looking for his knife. Jack spotted it a few feet to the man's left front. Too late. The man pushed himself to his feet and shuffled toward it. Jack charged, feet slipping in the mud as he tried to close the distance. The man bent over for the knife, almost tipping forward as he did so. Jack pushed off with his back foot, drove his knee upward. It slammed into the man's face, vaulting him backward into the barricade. Jack's feet slipped out from under him and he toppled backward into the mud. His head bounced against the ground. His vision sparkled.
"Move. Do something," he thought. "He's coming."
An image of himself flashed in his mind, flat on his back in the mud, throat slashed open, rain peppering his open eyes, the flash of a coroner's camera.
No. No way.
Jack rolled onto his side. 10 feet away, his attacker sat, half sprawled against the concrete barricade. His head lolled to one side. The gray concrete behind him was smeared with blood. The man was white, pale, in his mid-30s, with close-cropped light hair. Jack glimpsed what looked like white skull through his lacerated scalp.
"Stay there, man!" Jack shouted. "Don't move!"
Blinking as though confused, the man focused on Jack for a second, then rolled sideways and began working with his knees, like a toddler trying to crawl on a tile floor. He managed to climb to his feet.
"Tough son of a bitch."
Jack spotted the glint of the knife a few feet away, half buried in the muck. He crawled to it, grabbed it. It was a locking folder, almost 8 inches long and hefty.
"Just stop!"
Jack shouted, panting. He tasted blood in his mouth. He spit it out. His or the mugger's, he wondered.
"The cops are coming!"
He doubted this, but maybe it would be enough to either drive the man off or make him sit back down and accept his fate. And a free trip to the ER. Chances were, in the darkness and the rain, no one knew what was happening. Didn't know that Jack Ryan Jr., America's first son and unemployed special operator, was fighting for his life with a crackhead mugger in the mud beside a highway.
Christ almighty.
The man was moving now, but not toward Jack. With his left hand braced against the top of the concrete barricade, he shuffled forward, stopped, kept going. A car swept past him, honking, covering him in a sheet of water. The man didn't react. Brain injury, Jack thought. Despite himself, he felt a pang of...
what?
Of sympathy for a junkie who'd just tried to kill him? Come on, Jack. Still, he couldn't let the guy wander off, sit down in some doorway, and die of a brain bleed.
Ah, hell.
Just stop, Jack shouted.
Come back!
The man reached a gap between the Jersey barriers and his guiding hand dropped into free space. He stopped walking, looked down at his feet. A few feet away, a car swept past, horn honking. The man turned left and stumbled forward onto the highway.
Hey, don't!
Jack saw the headlights and heard the roar of the diesel engine a second before the 18-wheeler emerged from under the overpass. The truck's horn started blaring. Jack sprinted. The truck plowed squarely into the man. Jack stood rooted, staring, only half hearing the truck's air brakes wheeze and sputter.
Did that just happen? Do something. Move.
He turned and ran back toward the embankment. He stopped. Above, standing at the guardrail, a man was backlit by car headlights.
Hey, Jack called. Call 911.
The figure didn't move. Jack cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted again. The figure turned and disappeared. A few moments later, the headlights retreated into the darkness. Adrenaline was a hell of a thing, Jack thought, as was shock. He'd seen a lot of stuff, but something about this. The man hadn't even glanced at the truck bearing down on him. Jack stood in the shower, eyes closed, forehead pressed against the tile wall, as hot water rushed over his head. His hands were still shaking, pulsing in time with his heartbeat. He'd left, with the man's knife. He'd had the presence of mind to make sure he hadn't lost anything traceable. Phone, keys, wallet, receipt, the larger items from his grocery bag. But 90 seconds after the truck struck the man, Jack was pulling out of the Supermercado parking lot. It wasn't until he was halfway back to the Aeronico that he heard sirens. Was it the shock of it? Maybe. Or maybe he just didn't want to deal with the 10,000 questions the cops and media would start asking, not just of him, but of his father, his mother, his sisters, his brother, and his colleagues at Hendley. Tabloids and A-list media outlets alike would interview his ex-girlfriends and elementary school friends. The headlines would be salacious. Anyone gunning for his father on Capitol Hill would milk the story for all it was worth. All that aside, he was the victim. It was cut and dried. There was a witness, or at least a possible witness. Why had the man left? Jack hadn't escaped the assault unscathed. Despite having trapped the man's knife arm, the blade had gotten him. 3 shallow stabs right below his shoulder blade, none deeper than a half inch, but enough to leave his shoulder burning and partially numb. Jack wondered, were the wounds collateral to the struggle, or had his attacker been trying to drive the blade home? His slide down the cedar bushes had scratched and abraded his lower back and belly so badly it looked like someone had taken to him with a belt sander. Another worry. Had he swallowed some of the man's blood? If so, he had to start thinking about Hep C, or something worse. Guy tried to kill me, Jack thought. Why? Because he hadn't gotten his high for a couple hours? For the $22 and change Jack had in his pocket. For his car. This wasn't the first time someone had tried to take his life. But this felt different. Chapter 2. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack woke before dawn the next day, having slept fitfully. Even dozing, his mind had played and replayed the incident. Half dream, half reality, but always ending the same way. The mugger dying and Jack feeling, what? Like he'd done something wrong? He took another shower, mostly to re-clean his wounds, stood under the cold water as long as he could stand it, then got dressed, put his previous night's clothes in the washer, dumped in some bleach, and turned it on. In the kitchen, he made a double espresso, downed it, set the machine back to standard coffee, then went to the sink where he'd placed the mugger's knife. He put it in the dishwasher, started a hot cycle, then walked into the living room and turned on the TV. He changed the channel to the local news. This early in the morning, hours before the morning shows, they were repeating stories frequently, so it didn't take long. Police say a man was struck and killed by a vehicle on North Kings Highway near Telegraph Road last night, shortly after 8 p.m. He is yet to be identified. If you have any information, the police ask that you... Jack muted the television. Unidentified, Jack said. No mention of witnesses, which could mean something or nothing. If the figure at the guardrail had made a report, the police were just as likely to withhold the information until they could come at him with something solid, especially someone named Jack Ryan. For 20 minutes, he paced and drank coffee, occasionally leaning over his laptop to scan online news sites for more information. There was nothing. He wanted to call someone, to confide in someone, but he resisted the impulse. He needed to think. Better still, he needed to do something. With his mind only partially registering the pre-rush hour traffic, Jack drove back to the Supermercado. The rain had stopped falling, but overhead the clouds were still dark and swollen. Sidewalks and lawns were still wet, and potholes brimmed with water. Overhanging tree branches, showing the first hint of green buds, drooped under the weight of the moisture. It was past 7, the sun just coming up, and an hour before the supermercado opened. The parking lot appeared empty. Jack made a second pass, scanning for police cars. Seeing none, he made a U-turn, pulled into the lot, and parked in a stall close to the front doors. He climbed out. With his breath steaming in the morning air, he walked to the spot beside the guardrail where he'd parked the previous night. He stopped and looked down the embankment. Aside from a string of yellow police tape looped along the line of jersey barriers at the bottom of the embankment, the scene seemed unremarkable. In his mind's eye, he'd imagined his fight with a mugger had churned the slope into a jumble of mud, grass, and shredded cedar brush. Beyond the barriers, cars on the King's Highway streamed past at a steady pace. Jack glanced around. The parking lot was still empty. He climbed over the guardrail and picked his way down the embankment until he reached the flat area alongside the barriers. It was a goulash of mud and patchy green-yellow grass. On the other side of the barriers, the passing car's tires sent up billowing mist. Following his mental map, Jack found the barrier against which his attacker had fallen. He knelt before it. There was no trace of blood on the gray concrete. Either the rain or a first responder fire truck had washed it away. Jack stood up and walked along the barriers, looking for any trace of what had happened the night before. There was nothing. He headed back up the slope. 10 feet from the top, a flash of something caught the corner of his eye. He stopped, scanned the ground. Jutting from under a scrub brush beside his foot was the corner of a business card. Jack stooped over and picked it up. Not a business card, but a hotel key card. "Hey, what are you doing down there?" a voice barked. Jack looked up and saw a man in a dark blue suit standing at the guardrail, 1 foot resting on the post. "What's that?" "I said, what are you doing? Come here." The man removed a wallet from his suit pocket and flapped it open, displaying what Jack guessed was an Alexandria Police Department investigator's badge. "Come on, get up here." Shit. Jack took a breath, trying to slow his heart. With the hotel key card palmed, Jack climbed the remaining distance, then stepped over the guardrail. He stuffed his hands into his anorak's pockets. Under his right forearm, he felt the reassuring bulge of his Glock 26 in its hip paddle holster. "Take your hands out of your pockets," the cop growled. He was in his mid-40s, stocky like a wrestler, with wavy red hair. Jack did so, and the cop gave Jack a practiced head-to-toe scan. "What's your name?" "Jack Ryan." "ID?" Jack pulled out his wallet and handed over his driver's license. The cop studied it for 5 seconds, glancing from it to Jack's face several times before nodding slowly. "Huh. Are you?" "Yep," Jack replied. "Are you supposed to have a Secret Service detail or something?" "Officially, maybe. But I complained to their boss, so they gave me a pass." Jack smiled. The cop didn't reciprocate. "What were you doing down there?" Jack had been mulling this over in his mind. The odds were decent that sooner or later he was going to come into contact with the police over this. He wasn't expecting it to be this soon, however. Had the witness come forward? Jack hesitated, partially because he thought it would look right and partially because he'd started second-guessing his decision, then replied, "I was here last night." "You're committed now, Jack." Whether the lie he was about to tell was going to save him trouble or buy him more was yet to be seen. The cop's brows furrowed. He gave Jack the kind of hard-eyed stare that seemed to come standard issue to all cops. "When it happened?" "I think so." "Tell me, from the start." "I went to the gym." "Which one?" "Malone's, on Foundry, near the DMV." "Keep going," the cop said. "Then I came here for groceries. Must have been around 8. The cop held up his finger and glanced down at Jack's driver's license. This address. That's the Aronica, right? Supermercado's not exactly in your neighborhood, is it? They have the best fruits and vegetables. So I paid and came out. It was raining. About what time? 8:15 or so. I walked to my car and then heard, "Before or after you got in your car?" asked the cop. "Before," replied Jack. There was a flyer or something stuck to my windshield. I grabbed it, then heard honking coming from down there. It sounded like a truck, an 18-wheeler. A flyer, Jack thought. The word caught in his head. Before he could think about it, the cop said, "Then what?" "I put my grocery bag down." "Where?" "On the hood of my car," Jack said. "Peppers and tomatoes?" "What?" "The responding officer found some peppers and tomatoes on the ground right about here." "Oh, yeah, I was making chili. Anyway, I walked to the guardrail and looked down. I heard skidding, saw headlights, then heard a crash, I think." "You think?" the cop asked. "What's that mean?" "I mean, it was raining and dark, and I'm not sure what it was. It didn't sound like your standard car crash. When I got up this morning, I saw the news about the guy that was hit and put two and two together. And then drove down here to, what, render aid?" Jack didn't take the bait. For cops, biting sarcasm was often an effective interview tool, a way to put people on the defensive. Find an inconsistency, the scab of a guilty conscience, then pick at it and see what happens. It wasn't personal. Jack replied, "I don't know why. Wish I did. Guilt, maybe. If what I saw was..." "It probably was. Why didn't you call it in?" Jack shrugged. "I wish I had." The cop took this in, then nodded slowly. "Well, it wouldn't have made any difference. He was dead on scene. Just parts." "Did you know him?" "I don't know. Who was he?" "We're trying to figure that out." "What did he look like?" "You mean before?" the cop said with a grim smile. "Yeah, before." "Tall, thin, white, mid-30s. Jack shook his head. "Don't think so." "He didn't have any ID? Nobody's come forward?" "Nope." "So tell me, what's it like? The Oval Office, I mean." The question caught Jack off guard, perhaps as planned. "Like you see in the pictures. I'm not there much anymore. Dinner once a week, parties here and there." "You don't like being first son?" "It's okay," Jack replied. "I prefer my privacy. Luckily, I don't go to bars, don't forget to put on underwear, then get out of cabs in front of the paparazzi." The cop let out a belly laugh. "Yeah, that wouldn't be a good look for you. Your mom is nice as she seems on TV." "Every bit of it," Jack replied with a smile. "So tell me the truth. What were you really doing there? If it's nothing too bad, I can try to keep it under wraps." "I already told you. You think I'm lying?" "I've been a cop for 12 years. I think everyone's lying. Except for my dog, he never lies." Jack smiled. "Dogs are good like that." "What's your name?" "Doug Butler." He stuck out his hand. Jack shook it. The motion set off a flash of pain in his shoulder blade. Butler saw the wince. "You okay there?" Jack nodded. "Weighted pull-ups. I'm starting to think I should give them up." "What, you're into that CrossFit stuff?" "No, just fighting the ticking clock." "Listen, Officer Butler, I know it's odd, me coming here. Even if I couldn't have done anything for the guy, I should have called it in. I don't know how to explain it." This was the unvarnished truth. "Nah, I get it. It's a form of survivor's guilt. You might not have actually seen it, but in essence, you saw a guy die last night. That's a hard thing." Jack resisted asking if there were any other witnesses. Cops had many different kinds of radar, including one for people who were too curious or too helpful. Butler said, "You know I'm going to need a statement, Jack."
"I understand."
"Will it end up in the media? If so, I should probably let my dad's press guy know."
"Not likely. Just between us, the truck driver said the guy just stepped out of nowhere, didn't even look up. Probably never knew what happened."
"It's not a bad way to go, all things considered."
Jack detected no facetiousness in the statement. Consciously or subconsciously, Butler had given a lot of thought to how people died. A cop thing.
"No idea who he was?"
"My guess is he was homeless, maybe high. It happens. Why he was walking around in the rain, who the hell knows?"
"Why are you out here? Investigating, I mean."
"Standard practice for an unexplained death. We have to tick the boxes, make sure we don't miss anything. Plus, we're about 5 miles from the White House."
"What's that mean?"
"Nothing. Forget it."
Butler pulled a business card from his wallet.
"Write your number on that."
Jack did so. Then Butler handed him a second card along with his driver's license.
"I'll call you this afternoon for that statement. Over the phone should be good enough."
Jack was pulling into the Aronico's garage when his mind again looped back to the word flyer. He pulled into his parking spot, climbed out, then stood, hands in pockets, thinking.
"What is it?" he muttered.
It had been blank. The flyer on his windshield had been a blank piece of copier paper.
Chapter 3. Alexandria, Virginia. Muggers are opportunistic criminals, Jack knew. Their planning is limited. Their ambushes usually consist of blindsiding their victims. They don't use delay attention tools.
Another thing, who passes out flyers in a rainstorm? Thinking back, Jack didn't recall seeing flyers on any of the other cars' windshields. Was he overthinking this?
No.
The knife. He got up from the couch, walked into the kitchen, and opened the dishwasher. Using a dish towel, he pulled the still-hot knife from the utensil rack and laid it on the counter. He studied it, from the tip of the blade to the end of the haft, but found no markings save a lone 6-digit number beside the thumb stud. Jack pulled out his phone, took several pictures of the knife, uploaded them to his Dropbox account, then sat down at the dining table with his laptop. In his browser, he went to tineye.com, loaded the images, and hit the search icon. The results appeared instantly on his screen. The knife was made by Eichhorn Solingen, a model called Secutor. Jack Googled the company. It was based in Solingen, Germany, with plenty of online retailers. Jack clicked on several of them and found a price, $175. What was a crackhead doing with an expensive knife? At the first sign of withdrawals, a real junkie would have sold it for a couple rocks. Jack zoomed in on the knife. Along the blade's swedge was the word Secutor, beneath it a 4-digit number. Near the thumb stud was Eichhorn Solingen's logo, what looked like an upright squirrel holding a sword.
"Same knife, different markings," Jack said to himself.
Jack picked up his phone and scrolled through his contacts until he found what he was looking for. He tapped dial.
"Shiloh River Gun Club," the voice on the other end said.
"Is this Adam?"
"Yep, who's this?"
"Jack Ryan."
"Hey, Jack. Haven't seen you around for a while. You need to come in, put some rounds downrange."
"I know. Listen, I need a favor. A buddy of mine is looking at buying a knife on eBay, an Eichhorn Solingen. Nice blade. But the markings look odd. Can you take a look?"
Adam Flores was the co-owner of Shiloh River Gun Club, a private shooting club John Clark and Ding Chavez introduced him to. Outside of a military base, Shiloh River had one of the most realistic combat ranges on the eastern seaboard. He and Adam, a military aficionado, had become passing friends. If it went boom or was sharp, Adam knew about it.
This was normally a question Gavin Beery, the campus's director of information technology, would field. But that avenue wasn't open to Jack. Gavin had stuck his neck out for Jack countless times when he was an employee, and he'd probably do it now. But Jack wasn't going to put him in that position.
Sure, said Adam. Email the pics and I'll have a look around.
Thanks. Jack disconnected. From the pocket of his anorak, he pulled the hotel key card he'd found at the scene. Emblazoned on the card's blue front was a large red 6. Motel 6, Jack realized. But which one? He turned the card over, looking for markings. He found several, all number sequences. In turn, he typed each one into Google alongside the search term Motel 6. The third sequence, 1403, the franchise identifier apparently, found a match belonging to a motel in Springfield, about 8 miles west of Alexandria. This, too, made no sense. While Motel 6 wasn't exactly a five-star hotel line, it was branded, mid-priced, with what Jack thought was a decent reputation. Assuming this card belonged to his attacker, it wasn't the kind of dive motel a junkie would choose, or could afford. And why Springfield? Why not one of the half-dozen motels within walking distance of the supermercado? Jack realized his scalp was tingling. Someone had tried very hard to kill him last night, and that someone was looking less and less like a crackhead mugger. Having someone hunting for his head was nothing new. But this felt different. He realized his separation from the campus had lured him into a comfort zone. Isabel. Jack snatched up his phone and dialed her number, a flat owned by her father in London. Jack checked his watch. It would be mid-afternoon there. Before the line started ringing, he changed his mind and disconnected. Until he knew more, he didn't want to tell her what was happening. She would worry. She would be on the next plane out of Heathrow. He dialed Isabel's father's direct line. He answered immediately. Armand Kashani was no fan of Jack's. Rightly or wrongly, he held Jack responsible for an assault on his daughter. In an attempt to get to Jack, Yegor Morozov's people had nearly beaten her to death. She'd spent 3 weeks in the hospital before moving first to a private care rehabilitation facility in London, then to her father's flat. Jack didn't begrudge Armand's animosity. If and when Jack had a child of his own, especially a girl, God only knew how he'd react if that child was threatened. For her part, Isabel had been slowly but steadily working to change her father's mind about Jack. It seemed to be working.
Good afternoon, Jack. What can I do for you?
The man's tone sounded almost pleasant.
Almost.
Mr. Kashani, I may have a... Jack paused, searching for the right word. Problem you need to be aware of.
Which involves my daughter?
Probably not, but just in case. As she has been since the day she arrived, she's well protected, Jack. I have two former SAS gentlemen who are never far away.
That would do the trick, Jack thought. He hoped.
If, in fact, last night's attack had something to do with Morozov and some loose end Jack had missed, he'd prefer Isabel have all of Hereford there. Thinking of this, Jack felt a knot of anger in his belly. They came after her, and now him. They'd missed him, and he was going to turn that to his advantage.
I'll bet she loves that, Jack said to Armand.
She does not love that, not even remotely. But I love her, and until she's fully recovered, I wasn't disagreeing with you, sir.
Good. You will keep me posted on this trouble of yours?
I will. As I said, it's probably nothing. I'd suggest you don't say anything to her until I wasn't planning to. Take care, Jack. The line went dead. Jack laid the phone down on the table and walked to the balcony windows and looked out. Below, the Potomac River was swollen. Its calm surface hid the strong spring current. A pair of yellow racing shells, their crews heaving and leaning in unison, glided past the mouth of the bay. Jack watched until they disappeared from view.
Who wants me dead?
he wondered. And why?
And had the mystery figure been a part of it?
He got an answer to his first question, at least a partial one, an hour later, when Adam Flores called back.
Jack, you've got yourself a pretty unique blade there. It's an Eichhorn Solingen Secutor, all right, but not a commercial model. The blade's thicker, there's a lanyard slot.
Give me the condensed version, Adam.
Right. Eichhorn Solingen supplies the German Heer, the army, with all its combat knives, but most of those are fixed-blade KM2000 models. The one you've got is a special issue, a lot of 100 issued to the KSK, probably for special commendations and whatever.
KSK? Asked Jack.
Kommando Spezialkräfte, Special Forces Command. In 1997, the Bundeswehr rolled all its Spec 4 units into one. KSK is the cream of the elite, Jack. Think SEALs, Delta, Green Berets, and Marine Force Recon, all rolled into one.
This explained a lot, but also raised more questions. It explained why his attacker hadn't behaved like your typical mugger. It also explained, at least fuzzily, the figure he'd seen standing at the guardrail, the backup man in case his attacker failed. If so, why didn't he finish the job? On the other hand, why a knife at all? Why not a gun and a noise suppressor? He could have dropped Jack from 30 feet away and kept walking. Knives were silent, and perhaps the man's command to Jack, "Hey man, give it up," answered this. A cover story. If anyone happened to overhear and or witness Jack's murder, the details, from the man's appearance to his language to his choice of weapon, would fit. And for an ostensibly homeless crackhead, the trade-in value of a gun outweighed its usefulness. They'd chosen the right neighborhood for the attack. Finally, though the murder of the president's son would trigger outrage and a massive law enforcement response, a mugging gone bad would, if staged correctly, lead nowhere substantial. But a professional killing would see the government turning the country upside down. Someone had gone to a lot of trouble to assassinate him. If this had something to do with Yegor Morozov, the sophistication of the op made sense. But not the timing of it. Why wait so many months to come after him? The choice of knife, a rare and expensive Eichhorn Solingen Secutor, was also curious. What did that mean? Jack knew plenty of special operators who felt attached to a particular piece of gear, whether it was a knife or a plastic army man his son had given him. In this business, you took good luck totems wherever you found them. Was this the case with his attacker? Either way, one thing was certain. Whoever this was, they weren't going to stop at one attempt. And he had to assume Isabel was in fact on their radar. He had a choice: hide and call in reinforcements, or handle it himself. Hiding was a non-starter, even if it was in his nature, given the lengths to which his attacker had gone so far. Lying low would do no good. For now, he was taking the latter route. He'd take the fight to them.
Chapter 4. Alexandria, Virginia. Like most special operators, Jack maintained a go-bag, yet another lesson given him by John Clark and Ding Chavez. In Jack's case, his rucksack, a 5'11 tactical Havoc, was filled with the necessities of his chosen profession. His first order of business was a Hail Mary. While he had little doubt his comprehensive access to the campus's mainframe computer had been suspended, he wondered what might have been left available. Jack opened a browser on his laptop and navigated to the Hendley Associates website, then to its secure backdoor portal. Fingers crossed, he plugged in his username and password. After a moment, the portal's main window appeared. All of the access tabs were gray, ghosted out, save one, Level 1. Jack clicked on the tab, and a new screen opened up.
there was a message in his inbox. It was from Gavin Beery. In case you meet a sketchy woman at a bar. While Level 1 was just the tip of the campus's information iceberg, it did give him access to basic investigation tools. Through a shell company, Hendley Associates maintained a private investigation firm that served primarily to provide useful cover for its operatives. Enquester Services existed only in cyberspace, but its various licenses and documentation were irreproachable, including the private investigator's badge Jack carried. "Thank you, Mr. Beery," Jack muttered. He clicked to the tab marked Credit Inquiries. From his rucksack, he grabbed a magnetic barcode swiper, plugged it into his laptop's USB port, then slid his attacker's Motel 6 key. While he knew the location of the motel, Springfield, he didn't know which room the card belonged to. After a moment, the information appeared on the screen. Room 142. A piece of luck, Jack thought. Ground-level room with exterior access. The less interaction he had with the lobby staff, the better. Within minutes, he was on I-95 heading west. The rain was holding off. The afternoon temperatures had risen to the mid-70s, causing the still damp streets to steam. 15 minutes after leaving the Aronico, he turned onto Springfield Boulevard. The motel, a long whitewashed four-story building, overlooked the Franconia Road I-95 cloverleaf. Jack did a full circuit of the building, then followed the placards to an entrance on the east side. He found a spot 50 feet away, tucked up against a line of hedges, and backed into it. He shut off the engine. Jack felt his heart rate pick up. While his attacker certainly wasn't coming back, the mystery man was a possibility. The chances were better than even that he'd already cleaned out the room. Jack hoped not. This room was his sole lead. There was something else tickling his mind. Anticipation. He'd missed this, he realized. He missed the campus. He and Dom, Ding, and John Clark stayed in touch and had lunch or beers once a week or so. But it wasn't the same. Though they'd done nothing to prompt this, Jack had begun to feel like an outsider. What they all lived and breathed was Hendley's off-the-books missions. This was prevalent in the business, on both the civilian and military side, a natural byproduct of being good at a job that frequently tries to kill you. That was a fair, if generalized, definition of addiction, wasn't it? Maybe. If so, months of withdrawal and he still felt the lure of it. There were worse vices, right? He drew his Glock, eased back the slide until he saw the glint of brass in the chamber, then reholstered. He got out of the car and headed for the entrance. With the swipe of the key card, the door gave a satisfying click. Jack used the back of his thumb to pull open the door, then stepped into the vestibule. Through the inner door, he followed signs to room 142. The hallway was empty, but as he passed doors, he caught strains of muffled conversation, a game show playing on a television. He stopped before 142. A privacy please placard was hanging from the lever handle. Jack pressed his ear to the door, listened. All was quiet. He glanced down the hall again, saw it was clear, then drew the Glock, stepped closer to the door's hinge side jamb, and swiped the key card. He used his fist to push down the lever handle, then nudged the door open with his foot. He paused, listened again. Nothing stirred inside the room. He counted to 10, then took a breath. Let it out. With the Glock in the compressed ready position, Jack shouldered through the door and into the short hallway. Bathroom on his right. To his left was a closet with dual sliding mirrored doors. Both were open, and on the floor was a black hard-sided roller suitcase. Ahead he could see a chest of drawers and the foot of a queen bed and the window. The sheer curtains were drawn, casting the interior in pale light. As the door swung shut behind him, Jack backed up, putting more distance between himself and the bathroom door. He paced forward, checked the bathroom. Empty, door fully open, shower curtain back.
He took another step down the hall and peeked around the corner into the main room. Clear. He holstered the Glock. The room was like any other you'd find in a branded motel. Low-pile carpet, white walls, a bed with two nightstands, and a small round table and two chairs beside the window. The air smelled faintly of pine-scented disinfectant. Jack took a moment and stood still in the center of the room, taking it in. The space was tidy, but lived in. Here and there, things were out of place, the kinds of checklist details maids attend to. But the privacy please placard outside suggested housekeeping hadn't been here. There was nothing personal on the nightstands, chest of drawers, or table. No change, no receipts, no pocket detritus of any kind. The bed covers were pulled up, but the bed wasn't made. And no sign of drug paraphernalia. This wasn't the room of a homeless crackhead. Jack walked to the bathroom. Beside the sink, lined up beside each other, were a toothbrush and a miniature tube of toothpaste. In the shower, he found a half-empty bottle of complimentary shampoo and a used bar of soap in the holder. Hanging neatly from the curtain were a towel and washcloth, the latter folded once lengthwise, the former stiff from being air-dried. The trash can beside the toilet was empty. He returned to the main room, put on a pair of leather golf gloves, and started his search. The nightstands were empty, as were two of the chest's drawers. The uppermost one contained rows and stacks of staple clothing. Socks, underwear, jeans, plain cotton t-shirts in blue, black, and red. He carefully sorted through each item and found nothing. Not even labels, all of which had been cut out. He retrieved the suitcase from the closet and laid it on the bed. There were no luggage tags, either personal or airline issued. He unzipped the suitcase. It was empty. Jack ran his fingertips around the nylon fabric inner lining. Again, no luck. Jack returned the suitcase to the closet. This room was special operator tidy. A place for everything and everything in its place. Functional, efficient, anonymous. It gave him nothing. Maybe, Jack murmured. He picked up the phone and dialed the main desk. Motel 6, how may I help you? Hi, I'm in room 142, Jack said. Can you get me a copy of my charges up to this point? My office manager needs it. Certainly, sir, I can email it. Hard copy would be better, actually. Just slip it under the door. I'm going to jump in the shower. Give me 5 minutes. One more thing, Jack replied. When do you show me checking out? Hang on. Day after tomorrow, sir. Jack thanked him and hung up. The desk clerk was as good as his word. A few minutes later, a lone sheet of paper wormed its way beneath the door. He waited for the footsteps to fade back down the hallway, then retrieved the bill. In the occupant information section, there was no address. How did his attacker manage that? Jack wondered. The vast majority of hotels wouldn't book a reservation without an address. There were ways around this, but they took finesse. In the payment section, all but the last 4 digits of the credit card were X'd out. But there was a name. Eric Weber. Even assuming the name was real, Weber was common, as was Eric, and without an address, Jack had no way of narrowing his search. He put a pin in it and turned to his next task. He left the room, and to kill some time, he browsed through a couple used bookstores. After nightfall, he headed west toward Telegraph Road and turned off. He found a BP gas station across the road from the supermercado and parked on the side of the building. From his rucksack, he took a gray hoodie and baseball cap. He donned both, then locked his car and walked to Lenore, then west across Telegraph to the grocery store. The parking lot was half full of cars, with shoppers, mostly Latinos and some whites, coming and going through the automatic doors. The sound of rickety shopping cart wheels echoed across the pavement. The automatic doors hissed open and shut. It was 7:45, 15 minutes before the store's shift change. Jack couldn't help but glance at the guardrail on the far side of the parking lot. No cars were parked there. He stood in the near darkness for a few moments and scanned the front of the store for surveillance cameras. Though there were plenty of them inside, little mirrored bubbles jutting from the ceiling, out here he saw none. Jack pulled the cap down close to his eyebrows, then walked to the entrance and posted himself beside it. To each passerby he gave his rehearsed and, he hoped, well-acted spiel. He was looking for his homeless brother. Someone said they'd seen him around here, followed by a description of his attacker. Most walked past him, either without responding or with some muttered excuse or a flat no. Occasionally, a shopper would stop, listen for a moment, then sadly shake his or her head and wish him luck. At 7:55, a familiar face appeared, one of the regular cashiers, a short, early-20s woman with large black eyes. She'd checked him out a few times, but was shy and rarely looked him in the eye. "Hi, excuse me," Jack said. "I'm looking for my brother. He's missing." "I'm sorry," she murmured, stepping around Jack and heading for the door. "I need to—" "Tall, skinny, maybe wearing a dark hoodie? He's homeless. We're worried about him. Please." The cashier slowed, then stopped and turned. She backed farther into the light coming through the front windows, putting some distance between them. A local, he guessed. She gave no sign she recognized him. "How tall?" she asked. 6'5" or so. The woman hesitated, then said, "Wait, there was a guy. I seen him a few times in the last week. He was panhandling, asking for change. I gave him a few dollars, but felt kind of stupid, you know." "Why?" "I came in early for my shift last night, about 7:30, and I saw him get dropped off right down there." She pointed toward the far end of the building. 7:30, Jack thought. A half hour before he arrived. Good timing. Here was another habit he'd let slip, that of varying his daily routine to make himself a harder target for both surveillance and ambush. She said, "It was a real nice car, not a beater or anything. I figured if he had a car like that or had a friend with a car like that, he shouldn't be creeping for money." Jack frowned. "I'm sorry he did that. He's got problems, if you know what I mean." "Yeah, I get it." "What did the car look like?" he asked. "White, newer, like a Nissan or Toyota. Mid-size. Did you see the driver?" She shook her head. "Wait a second. There was something on the news. Wasn't some guy hit on King's Highway last night?" "Really?" Jack replied. "Did they describe him? Did he have ID? "No, I don't know. Sorry, you could call the police. I hope it's not him, but maybe..." She let the words trail off, tilting her head in sympathy. "I gotta go." "Thanks," Jack said, as she disappeared through the doors. White mid-size car. Did the headlights silhouetting his mystery man the previous night belong to this car? Jack drove home, parked in the garage, then took the elevator up to his floor. The doors parted, revealing the vestibule. Sitting on the leather bench against the far wall was Doug Butler. Jack stepped out. "Hey, detective," he said tentatively. Butler stood up. "We gotta talk." Chapter 5. Alexandria, Virginia. How did he get back on Butler's radar? He'd already given the detective a statement over the phone, one that seemed to satisfy the cop. Jack went through the possibilities. He'd contradicted his earlier statement. A witness had come forward. They'd found trace evidence on the scene that put him there. Inwardly, Jack winced. He was thinking like a criminal. He didn't like the feeling. He unlocked his door and stepped inside, with Butler following. Jack flipped switches on the wall, illuminating the kitchen and living room. He stepped into the kitchen. "I was about to ask how you got up," Jack said, "but you've got a hell of a hall pass, I guess." "Comes in handy," Butler replied. "You want something?"
A beer, coffee?
Yeah, a beer'd be good.
So what do you carry?
Jack turned. Butler was standing in the archway, hands shoved in his pants pockets.
What?
Asked Jack. In your hip holster.
Glock 26.
I've got a permit.
I know you do. Were you carrying when we met at the supermercado?
When Jack nodded, Butler gave a sad shake of his head. Can't believe I missed it. Getting old.
I paid extra for the holster of invisibility, Jack replied with a grin.
Butler snorted. Not quite a laugh, but as close as he got to one, Jack suspected. He grabbed a pair of Heinekens from the fridge and handed one to Butler, who unscrewed the cap and took a swig. He held up the cap.
Garbage?
Counter's fine, Jack replied and took his own sip.
You want me to ditch the gun?
Nah.
Just don't draw on me. Might give me a heart attack.
Nice place. You rich?
Everything's relative.
You work at a financial company, right? Hendley something?
Hendley Associates.
Yep. Arbitrage, analysis, that sort of thing.
Sounds interesting.
Everything's relative, Jack repeated. I'm on a kind of sabbatical, I guess you could say. This was the first time he'd explained his situation to anyone outside of his family.
Sabbatical. Forced leave of absence.
Each term was accurate enough,